From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
It means that everyone in the state should not be questioning the policy, but trying to figure out how it can be implemented in the most effective and efficient way.
Judges will articulate the reasons that they are holding someone or the reasons that they are releasing someone.
It makes it harder to keep those who could be dangerous locked up.
There are going to be instances in which where we think detaining somebody is appropriate under the facts and will be unable to do so, and everybody in the courtroom will see the issues with releasing an individual and will have no recourse.
There is mixed reaction to an Illinois Supreme Court decision this week regarding what is known as the Pretrial Fairness Act. Basically, it does away with cash bail. And after months of being delayed, the court has said Illinois can become the first state to do this. It will happen in September. We're going to talk about that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Charlie Wheeler is on vacation this week. Joining us, we have Jeremy Gorner. He's a State House reporter with the Chicago Tribune. And Jeremy, thanks for being with us once again.
Happy to be here, Sean.
Also, we have Shannon Heffernan. She covers criminal justice for WBEZ. And Shannon, great to have you along as well.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Shannon, before we get to the court action, let's start off with what this is all about. It's a bit confusing, I think, to people because it's called many different things. Part of a larger package called the Safety Act, but this part specifically deals with cash bail. And what have been the arguments both for and against this?
So the argument for it is people say cash bail doesn't actually keep us safer, right? You're making a decision in the court about who to hold based on whether or not they can afford to pay their bail. And they argue instead those decisions should be made based on things like safety. Is somebody going to be a threat to the public? Or is someone at risk of fleeing? Now, the pushback against that is the law as it's written, there's people who argue it's going to let too many people go free while they're awaiting trial. There are standards that have to be met in order for someone to be eligible for detention. And even people who say theoretically they're in favor of ending cash bail, a few of them have come out and said, you know, the standards as outlined in this law, they make the bar too high for holding somebody behind bars. So that's really the clash you've seen around this law.
Yeah, and for the those on the that support this change, you know, they seem to be saying and have said along for a long time, it's not about whether somebody is a criminal who is going to cause more crime if they're let out necessarily. That's not really what bail is all about. Bail really is about who can afford to pay. And of course, you have wealthy defendants out there who wind up being able to meet bail and they're able to be released. And then you have people who are not. So this becomes more of an economic issue, more of a class issue, doesn't it?
Yes, exactly. They argue that this is really a punishment of poverty. You know, you have folks who may get a $1 million bail, but if they can afford to pay that, they're going to be released. And the argument is that's not appropriate. Money does not play a role in this. The other thing that advocates for ending cash bail have pointed to is in places where pretrial detention has been majorly pulled back, you've not actually seen a rise in violence. Crime. In Cook County, we had a major drop in pretrial detention due to some changes that were made at the court there. And you didn't see that correlated with that. That said, anytime I mention criminal justice statistics, I am very careful because there's all kinds of things that can make crime go up and down. And I think it's inevitable as we see this roll out, you'll see crime go up and down. And so I think that as we see that, we're going to want to be really thoughtful and careful about drawing conclusions until you have a larger body of data and a longer stretch of time to look at.
Well, going back to last year, Jeremy, people might remember this became quite a big issue during the campaign. We heard Darren Bailey, many Republicans out there saying that if this happens, you know, or were to take effect, we're going to see crime go up, as was mentioned there. And of course, Democrats defending it in many cases. There was also some legislation, I believe, passed a sort of a tweaking of the law in the fall. Can you kind of catch us up to date on what happened with that?
Yeah, just there were a couple of key things. So first of all, you know, a lot of
a lot of Republicans and just opponents in general of the pretrial provisions were arguing a couple things regarding what the law says about Class B and C misdemeanors and about the flight risk standard. So first of all, just to kind of, recap, judges under the new system will be able to evaluate whether a defendant is, they'll look at the dangerousness standard, whether someone's a threat to the community or whether they're a flight risk. So let's start with the flight risk standard. There were some opponents who were worried that the flight risk standard was not strong enough, didn't have any teeth, basically there was an argument going around that the flight risk standard is too high, that you really have to find somebody who has a plane ticket, a defendant who's out pretrial, who is caught red-handed with a plane ticket, showing that they have an intention to flee prosecution. That's how some folks who oppose this felt that the law read. So that was tweaked basically during a veto session to clarify basically that a pattern of no-shows in court could be used as evidence that a defendant is a flight risk. Now back to Class B and C misdemeanors. When we talk about Class B and C misdemeanors, like the main misdemeanor we're talking about is trespassing. You had a lot of opponents who were saying that, according to the way that this law is read, if somebody is standing on my property, a total stranger, and I want them off my property, the police can't arrest them, which a lot of proponents, of the law dismissed as nonsense. But just for clarification purposes, there was language that was tweaked at the end of veto session that basically says that, anybody who is a danger or a threat, a danger to themselves or a danger to the community can be arrested for a Class B and C misdemeanor like trespassing. And it was interesting, Sean, because I don't know if you remember the floor debate on that, but even I what I recall off the top of my head was a back and forth that involved State Rep Kelly Cassidy, a very progressive, Democrat in favor of the Safety Act, who in her Q&A with one of the lawmakers said, the law was basically clear enough though, right? Police can arrest you for trespassing if you're a threat. And I believe that this back and forth was Cassidy and Justin Slaughter, who was the main sponsor of the Safety Act. And he said, that absolutely that's true. But, to appease opponents who thought that the language wasn't clear enough, that change was made, basically. And another thing I'd like to say too, Sean, to Shannon's point just now, she obviously raised an interesting point about the data thing. And it's been expressed to me, opponents say that under the new system, there's this fear that, there's going to be more crime because more dangerous individuals are going to be let out early. But, of course, there's no proof of that. And even in the current system, a lot of the crimes that you see that are reported in the news media dealing with repeat offenders really represent a pretty small fraction of all crimes committed in the criminal justice system, number one. And number two, what it's been expressed to me is one of the things that we should be on the lookout for data wise is what the makeup of these crimes look like. Look at who's in the Cook County Jail now, for instance, what they're charged with. Let's look a year down the line and see what the makeup of the jail looks like now. One of the things that's been expressed to me is, it would be interesting to see if you're seeing more people arrested for domestic battery, yes, for example, that are locked up, even for misdemeanor domestic battery, locked up in the Cook County Jail, because under this new dangerousness standard, a judge can detain somebody for that, even though it's just a misdemeanor. So that's something that's just among the main things I think in the next year, I'm sure, reporters like Shannon and myself are going to look at.
And I think if I could chime in there, I think that's a really important point. I think often you hear this discussed in a way as if currently everybody who's a possible risk is being held, right? And that's just not true. Like most people accused of crimes at some point do walk free pre-trial. Now, there may be more of a delay where they're held in the jail and all of that. But I think that to understand how this is going to play out, you have to be a little bit in touch in the reality of what's happening right now.
Well, Shannon, there were arguments made by the people who have opposed this that the state was overstepping in some cases, the legislature was overstepping, that they were taking some of the judges' discretion away. But the justices at the Illinois Supreme Court did not agree with that, correct?
Right. So just to kind of explain that, you might remember in middle school when we all learned about the separation of powers, right? You have the three branches of government. There's that old Schoolhouse Rock song. They can't step on each other, right? So basically the argument here was this was the legislative branch telling judges what they can do, and that's not okay. The Supreme Court disagreed with that. You can think about the argument this way, for example. The legislators have passed things like mandatory minimums, right? That, to some degree, tells judges what they can and can't do. So while there is clear separation of powers, that doesn't mean that the legislative and the judicial branch and the executive branch might not have ways that they're in conversation with each other and influencing each other.
Jeremy, has there been talk about additional changes to this in some way, or is it too soon to look at that?
I mean, I think it's too soon to tell. I mean, I think, you know, we saw, and please correct me if I'm wrong, Sean, I believe that the trailer bill was the second or third iteration of the Safety Act this past December. I haven't heard of any other changes that are on the horizon. I know that, you know, Senate Republican leader John Curran had called for a special session, right? You know, ahead of the 60-day deadline, whether, you know, obviously the Republicans are in the super minority, that looks highly unlikely that that's going to happen. I think a lot of state's attorneys who were part of the lawsuit, you know, are conditioning themselves to whether they agree with the Supreme Court decision or not, to prepare as if they are going forward in 60 days with, you know, with the new detention system. So I think absent any pressure where the, you know, Democrats feel like they really have to do something, they're not in an election year, right? And they're in the supermajority. It looks like it's more likely than not that they won't institute any changes. I mean, I have not heard anything that's, that's coming forward in veto session or anything like that.
And Shannon, I know you've mentioned in your story too that implementation of this, there may be some things that have to change a bit or take place in the judicial system. Have you heard of anybody saying, hey, here's more of a reasonable approach or something like that, that maybe people want to see done, maybe on both sides might be agreeable to?
So I think there's two ways to talk about that. I think the first way is just practical brass tacks. Like, I think that this is a major change. For example, state's attorneys are going to have a higher burden to meet. They have to contact victims. They're required to let victims know about these detention hearings. All that's going to take more resources. So I think when you see that in larger counties, they'll probably be able to handle that. I'll be curious to watch how smaller counties are able to make that work. There has been a really long stretch of time since this law has passed. So people have had time to be thinking about this and preparing. That said, I can imagine there might be, I haven't heard this directly from anyone, but I can imagine there might be state's attorneys who were just kind of hoping it wouldn't go through and maybe haven't done that groundwork that they need to do to have the resources available for it to work. Also, any time you have legislation that is this massive, there's always going to be questions of interpretation. Now, the Supreme Court ruling is pretty darn clear. There's a lot of clarity that's been added. You had that trailer bill that Jeremy talked about that also added a lot of clarity. But I wouldn't be surprised if you still see some of that playing out in the actual courtrooms as judges make decisions based on these standards, that some of that might make its way up through an appeals process, and that there'll be a period of time when people are still kind of figuring out what it's going to mean practically.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel includes Jeremy Gorner with the Chicago Tribune and also Shannon Heffernan with WBEC. And Jeremy, one of the arguments in favor of this change is that, and I've heard this from several people, there are arguments saying that it will allow the justice system and prosecutors to focus on more serious crimes. Yet I'm hearing also that there's a little bit more work that's going to have to be done in many cases. So I guess I don't understand that. How is that going to allow them, or maybe free them up to do different things?
Well, basically, the way it works now, defendant gets arrested, detectives have up to 48 hours before prosecutors decide whether that person could be charged. This is, I'm talking about for felonies, and then they appear for a bond hearing, right? Well, where cash bail is set, depending on the seriousness, of course, there'll be no bail if it's a ultra serious crime, like a murder, basically. But in this new system, you're basically going to look at two hearings, right? You're going to look at an initial hearing where a number of felony defendants appear before a judge. From the initial hearings, you have the detention hearings, which happen within 48 hours of those first hearings. And that's really where judges will decide whether you're going to remain detained or you're going to be released. And in this case, there's going to be, the prosecutors are going to have to do more work, basically, to accommodate this change. They're going to have to, in a sense, they could find witnesses. They could, present some evidence or cursory evidence, whatever they have at the time. But what state's attorney's offices are doing, what they really do now is during bond hearings, they'll just rattle off a defendant's criminal history if they have it. And then a judge will make a decision on bail, setting bail from there, where this is going to be a little more robust, where you're going to see some kind of cursory evidence, whatever prosecutors have at the time, to convince a judge that this person should be detained, basically. This is going to require more prosecutors that are added to their felony review sections. I know that that's what Eric Reinhart, the Lake County State's Attorney, said that he's ready to do. Obviously I'm sure that other state's attorney's offices are following suit. I know that in DuPage County, Bob Berlin, who's Republican state's attorney there, he was the only Republican on a panel with lawmakers that was helping make some of those Safety Act changes in December. He was telling me that their courthouse, they had to make $20 million in improvements to accommodate a new courtroom, because of these changes. I mean, this is going to this is not just going to impact prosecutors. It's also going to impact assistant public defenders as well. So, so these are just like among some of the differences that you're going to see. And the thing is that, in Cook County right now, a typical day in bond court, what I'll be curious to see is, a typical day in bond court could be, you could have 1 to 200 defendants. It could be like 3-4 hours, for a typical, for bond court. And, but now with these hearings being probably more thoughtful and, more robust, more deliberate, it'll be interesting to see, how many defendants appear before a judge each day and how long, bond hearings, basically occur. What Berlin told me is that they're probably going to have more. I remember he told me this last year, they're probably going to have more set times during the day when they're going to hold initial hearings or detention hearings, compared to, the way that they hold bond hearings now. I hope that all makes sense. Sorry.
Well, to just chime in there too about the saving of the resources that you asked about, Sean. I think that everything Jeremy said is right in terms of there's going to be all these ways that more resources are required, but there are some ways that I could imagine resources being saved by this and therefore being able to be reallocated. For example, I think almost everyone expects the jail population in a lot of these counties to drastically drop. What resources is that going to save? And are they the kind of resources that can be moved around, right? I also think you have, there's going to be more latitude for police to be able to issue these citations for someone to appear in court instead of taking them in for very low level crimes. Are you going to see that save resources? So I think it's going to, you're going to be watching both sides of the equation here, but there's no doubt that there's ways it's going to require more from certain players in the court.
Well, before we leave this topic, and I'll open this up to both of you, but I guess a question I would look at is, I know this has been in place in some other jurisdictions, but Illinois being the first state to do this, is, I guess, why is Illinois taking that step? Is it the most progressive? Has it worked in other places? It seems like I've heard mixed results in certain jurisdictions across the country. So are we the guinea pig for, and will we be the guinea pig for this going forward?
We're the first state to entirely explicitly eliminate cash bail. Now, there have been other states that have gotten pretty close to that line, New Jersey, for example. So there are other places we can point to and learn lessons from and see how that's played out. But yes, Illinois is going to be the first one that it's entirely ended for. And I think you're going to have a lot of places watching very carefully what's happening in Illinois. And I think you're going to be seeing them watch it on two fronts. I think you're going to be seeing them watch practically what it means for safety, what it means for racial justice, what it means for stabilizing communities. But I also think you're going to be see people watching what it means politically and have already watched what it means politically. I think that it's been really scary for a lot of politicians to move forward with something as major as big bail reforms like this. But you've seen here in Illinois, you know, not only has the state Supreme Court upheld it, but you saw the governor withstand some backlash over this law. You saw in our mayoral election us elect someone who's very progressive around criminal justice issues as this bail stuff was playing out here. So I'll be interested to watch if that emboldens other areas of the country to make more progressive reforms, if there'll be maybe a little less fear around it.
I think what you're going to see, you know, especially is that there's going to be a lot of naysayers, of course, you know, like I was saying earlier, a lot of crime briefs that we see reported in the news, somebody who's let off on a low bail, for example, goes out and is accused of a more serious crime. I mean, again, you know, these are, again, that represents a sliver of the criminal justice system. And I think that, you know, we're probably going to continue to see some of that, just because that's just the nature of the criminal justice system, you know, that it, you know, unfortunately, that happens, you know. But, you know, I would think that, you know, naysayers are probably going to use that to say, hey, I told you so, where I think progressives who have been championing this system are still going to continuously, you know, and vigorously fight and prove that this was definitely a change that was needed in Illinois. And I say that because, like, you know, obviously Shannon was talking about New Jersey, and of course there's other states. I mean, you know, you look at statistics, I mean, recidivism rates, you know, are still relatively low. I mean, when it comes to, you know, the bail reforms that were made. And let's just look at bail reform in general in Cook County anyway. I mean, we started to see bail reform beginning around 2016, 2017, right? You know, coinciding with Kim Fox's tenure as state's attorney. And I mean, you know, crime in Chicago, I'm just bringing up Chicago as an example. I mean, you know, gun violence, let's say, you know, of course, the most serious of the serious crimes, you know, anything dealing with death or serious injury, was going down for like 3 years into bail reform. And then the pandemic hit. And, you know, pandemic, of course, disrupted, entirely disrupted everyday life, including the crime dynamic. So point is that, you know, tying bail reform to a rise in crime, you know, there really hasn't been, you know, much proof of this. And it's part of this. That's why going from bail reform to extreme bail reform, where there's no bail, you know, cash bail at all, that's something that people are obviously going to look at. But like I was saying earlier, too, you might see, you know, kind of like what Shannon was saying, you might see police having more latitude to write citations. You might see fewer people in the jails. But again, you might see more people. We don't know how this is going to play out. You might see more people who are in the jails that we wouldn't expect to be in the jails under the current cash bail system, you know, because prosecutors were able to prove, to convince a judge that, hey, this person's dangerous and they belong locked up pre-trial. You know, you might see progressives who are upset over some of those decisions. So we're just going to have to see how that all plays out.
And media is going to play a major role in that. I think that for understandable reasons, violent crime is a really emotional issue. So when people see a violent crime happen, we all hope that there would have been a way to prevent that. And I think we in the media have a really serious job here.
Yep.
To not sensationalize some of those incidents that inevitably will happen. They happen now. They happen before bail reform. People got released and did terrible crimes. They'll happen after bail reform. And we're going to have to make sure we're adding, no matter what, how you feel about the issue, adding that clarity, right? And I also think we're going to have to be adding that clarity when it comes to things like crime data, the kind of analysis you just heard Jeremy do with thinking about, well, you know, there was also the pandemic that happened. And, you know, so the rise in crime did not correlate with bail. So I think that's going to be a really serious job all of us who are on the side of information are going to have to take as we see this roll out.
Well, just a couple of minutes left here, and I do want to mention another topic. Shannon, you've been reporting on this quite a bit, and it deals with prison health care. The state does contract for that with a company known as Wexford Health Sources, but I believe the contract is going to be up for renewal. Where do things stand at this point?
Yeah, so the contract has actually already expired. It's been extended by the state, but it's been open for bids. And there was a moment in time when it looked like the state might be going a different direction. They put out, this gets a little in the weeds here, but basically they put out a bid that was formatted so it could break up the state into smaller pieces. And if that was true, you might have been able to see some smaller places go for those bids. But then they lumped it all together. So essentially, it's very likely, weird things happen, but it's very likely that Wexford or another similar large company will get it. So why does that matter? That sounded like a bunch of bureaucratic stuff. It matters because Wexford has had a really terrible history here in Illinois of providing healthcare that meets basic constitutional standards. You've had monitors, independent monitors come into the prison system and note deaths that could have been prevented. You have an incredibly high vacancy rate for medical providers inside the prison. And that's leading to all kinds of issues. So this is something that I will be watching very closely because people's health and literally lives are at stake. It's not like when you're in prison, you can go out shop for a different doctor. So we'll be watching that as that comes through in the next in the coming months.
So does Wexford provide all of the healthcare or does the state do some of it as well?
So Wexford is providing the vast majority of healthcare right now. That said, there is a pilot program that looks at a university system being able to supply some of the healthcare. That's a pilot program that I think a lot of people who are progressive on prison issues thought might lead to something larger because, you know, a public university system could be more held more accountable. There'd be more transparency. But based on how the contract's structured, I think it's unlikely we're going to see something like that scale up in the near future.
Okay. Well, we're out of time for this episode of State Week. Our panel today included Shannon Heffernan with WBEZ and Jeremy Gorner with the Chicago Tribune. Remember, you can find our show where you get your podcasts and through the NPR One app, also at nprillinois.org. Just look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.